Today's program was brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef Story. I'm Eric Murnigan, president of the International Culinary Center, and your guest host for this episode. Joining me today in Soho at the ICC is one of the bright lights of the culinary world, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt of the Food Lab. Kenji is the managing culinary director of SeriousEats.com, author of the James Beard Award-nominated column, The Food Lab, and is a columnist for Cooking Light. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, Wired Magazine, and Men's Health. He is the author of the recently published award-winning book, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. Welcome, Kenji.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I look forward to learning more about you today.
All right.
So why don't you start by telling me where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in New York. I was born in Boston, but my family moved here to New York when I was about 3 years old. I grew up in Morningside Heights, where my mom still lives.
Okay. Yeah. And would you say that your parents were foodies?
Not at all. I mean, my dad maybe a little bit. My dad likes to go out to eat. My mom does not like to go out to eat, actually thinks it's a waste of money. But, I think my mom was a decent cook, but she was a very sort of functional cook. You know, she cooked because she had three kids and we had to eat. She came from Japan when she was a teenager. So the food she cooked was sort of, sometimes it was Japanese food and sometimes it was sort of like, 1970s American staples, you know, like Salisbury steak, things like that. Basically, as soon as the kids moved out of the house, she stopped cooking. Like, she doesn't enjoy cooking. I definitely wouldn't call her a foodie. My dad does enjoy cooking, but I didn't grow up with cooking at all. You know, I didn't start cooking. Actually, my first restaurant job was basically the first time I'd ever really cooked.
Okay. So there's been a lot of discussion, and you've certainly participated in this discussion on taste memories and how taste memories kind of define some of the culinary regionality and how people feel about grandma's cooking and that sort of thing. So talk to me a little bit about some of your early childhood taste memories and food experiences.
I guess the one I remember most and the favorite thing for all of us kids that my mom made was dumplings, like Japanese style gyoza. And that was something that we actually participated in. So she would sit us down at a low table in front of the TV, like maybe every 2 months or so, and we'd have like a stack of wrappers and a bowl of filling. And so me and my sisters would fold and pleat all the dumplings, and then we'd freeze them all and then eat them over the next couple months or so. So those dumplings, objectively looking back on it now, like objectively, they weren't that great. They're not what I would call great dumplings if I went out to a restaurant and ordered dumplings. People, you're influenced by context. And so, you know, for me, those dumplings, I think, are still sort of the standard, like the gold standard for what they would be one of my death row meals, you know, eating those dumplings.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of foods like that. I saw the article in the Times yesterday. I think you're quoted in about pot roast.
Oh, right. Yeah, pot roast.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, elevated pot roast, but really is rooted in grandma's recipe or mom's recipe and what we identify with as maybe, you know, American foods or simple foods growing up. But now we as chefs are starting to elevate these and treat them a little bit differently.
Yeah. You know, well, that's I think sort of one of the things I was trying to do in the Food Lab and still trying to do in the column on the Food Lab is, people for a long time, I think there were certain foods that were taken seriously and it was, a lot of people, when they think food science or they think technique, they don't think of like a hamburger or a hot dog, but there's just as much science behind a good, like, you've done this, you know, you've been to a friend's house And they have a, and then they have, you know, they have a cookout and they make you a hamburger and it's pretty good. And then you go to another friend's house and it's, they're starting with the same basic ingredients, but one of them is going to probably going to be a lot better than the other. And that really just comes down to technique. So, you know, there is just as much technique, and science behind what makes a hamburger good as there is behind any other food. And I think it took a while for people to get to the point where they started taking those simple foods seriously. You know, so when I'm writing about something like a burger, the goal is never really to sort of alter the outcome. It's not to make like a new kind of burger, but it's really just to come up with a recipe or a technique that that sort of exemplifies what a burger should be and what, you know, so that the end product is sort of the burgeriest burger you've had, you know, but it's still instantly recognizable as a hamburger or a meatloaf or whatever it is.
You know? Okay, so in your book. And I may be misquoting it, but you say ground meat, or I think you say sausage is now the way meat should be, or something to that effect.
Well, no, not the way meat should be, but so sausage, I consider it to sort of be perfect meat in that, you know, most other meats, you're starting with a whole cut from an animal, and you have to kind of work around any deficiencies in it, right? So like a chicken breast, there's not a lot of fat in it, so you have to deal with that while you're cooking it, or you know, like a beef chuck is very tough, so you have to figure out a way to work around that. Whereas sausage, you're kind of going the other way around. You're making it into something that you want it to be before you even start cooking it. So it has the right level of tenderness, it has the right level of fat, it has the right level of salt, and all those things are kind of just built into a sausage from the get-go.
Yeah, that's interesting. I loved yesterday. You worked with our students a little bit yesterday and had two balls of ground meat that you wound up throwing at a student as a demonstration. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, so the demo was basically we had, we ground some pork shoulder fresh, and one batch was salted and the other was not. And essentially that was the only difference. The salted one we also kneaded a little bit. But you know, it makes such a huge difference in the texture. And I think a lot of people don't realize it. I know, like, my mom didn't realize it. And I was explaining this at the beginning of the demo that, you know, when I do a lot of recipe testing and when I lived in New York, I would give a lot of leftovers to my mom. She's on a low sodium diet, so I would always make things with a little bit less salt, knowing that I was going to give them to her later on. But one of the exceptions was sausage, because you can't really make a sausage with less salt because the texture doesn't come out right. And the reason is because, you know, that salt dissolves proteins and it helps them cross-link. And the salt is really what gives a sausage its kind of springy texture. So if you take pork shoulder, grind it plain, and then salt it and grind it, and then form patties and fry them, the texture is completely different, to the point where, well, in the demo, we threw them against a sheet tray, and, you know, the unsalted one kind of splatters and flies apart into 1,000 pieces, whereas the salted patty, it kind of bounces off in one single piece, and, you know, that's sort of what a sausage should be to me. And it's also the same reason why I don't mix salt into my hamburgers, because I want a hamburger to be sort of loose and tender and juicy and not sort of springy. So when I'm making a burger, I only season the outside. But if you're making sausage, you have to season it throughout.
So I'm kind of a food geek. I certainly love learning more about food. I have a lot of experience cooking professionally and home cooking. So we could talk about these things forever, but I'd like to learn more about you. So tell me a little bit about your background, really your evolution from a young adult to where you are today.
Well, you know, my upbringing was, you know, my education when I was growing up was very much science and math focused, because, you know, my father's a scientist and my grandfather's a scientist, and my mother wanted me to be a scientist or a doctor or something like that. Yeah, so that was, you know, that was the focus of my education all the way up through college, and I ended up going to an engineering school, I was going to be a biology major, about halfway through college, I started to realize that I didn't really love the sort of day-to-day lab work involved in biology. I just found it a little tedious. So that's when I started looking for, you know, other things to possibly do. And I kind of accidentally fell into cooking then, because I'd never really cooked before. I wasn't really looking for a job as a cook. But I happened to walk into a restaurant looking for a job as a waiter, actually, for one summer. Instead, they offered me a job as a cook, because luckily they had a prep cook who didn't show up that morning, and so they were shorthanded, and they were like, oh, here's this like dumb kid off the street who will work for very little money and offered me a job for the summer. I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then that was, you know, that was sort of my first foray into cooking and eating and working in kitchens. And since then, you know, that I pretty much instantly knew that that's what I wanted to do, you know, something food related, because I just loved the everyday work of a kitchen. You know, I love peeling lemons, and I love chopping onions, you know, that like all those things that you have to do sort of repetitively, but get better and better at each time. I love all that kind of work. And so let's see, how did I get from there to what I'm doing now? You know, I worked in restaurants for a number of years, part-time through the end of college and then full-time afterwards. And for me, the only thing that was really sort of missing from the restaurant experience was the science element. You know, I still had a sort of naturally inquisitive nature and sort of a built-in skepticism, which I think you get from having a science background. At least in a professional kitchen setting where you're at a restaurant and your main goal is to produce food consistently and on time, like those, there's not really much time for skepticism or inquiry. And I don't mean that to say that as a sort of detriment to restaurants. It's just the reality of how they work, because you're under such such time pressure all the time. So it wasn't exactly the best environment for kind of asking the kind of questions that kept popping up, like, why are we cooking this way? Why don't we do it that way? What happens if we try it this way? And most of the time you're just told not to ask questions because you don't have the time. You don't have the time to explore those things.
Chefs also don't like to feel threatened sometimes.
Well, that too. Yeah.
especially by the junior guy who's been a prep cook for a couple of weeks.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. I wasn't always loved in kitchens for asking these kinds of questions. I got told many times that there is such thing as dumb questions. But you know, so I worked in restaurants for many years though, but through this whole time I had these kind of questions that kept coming up, and I kind of had, you know, like a notebook full of these questions, like why do I do it this way, why do I do it that way, and I knew that at some point I wanted to try and answer all those questions, and so that opportunity came eventually when I took a job as a test cook at Cooks Illustrated magazine. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I, you know, there were a couple of reasons that I left restaurants. Partly it was because I wanted to explore this other side of cooking. I think like a lot of people, you get a little burned out with the hours, and burned out by not ever seeing friends and family. The opportunity for this test cook job came along, and so I took it, and that was that was a pretty perfect fit for me, because I was finally getting to do. Still cooking and still exploring food, but also sort of getting paid to answer these questions that I'd always had. And the writing sort of followed from there. You know, at least at Cooks Illustrated, everybody, all the test cooks are also the writers of the stories, because they're always done in this sort of first-person perspective, which is not to say that every writer there is a good story. Like, at Cooks Illustrated, stories are heavily, heavily edited, because people are hired first for their cooking skills and their kitchen testing skills, and secondarily as writers. And that's sort of why all the Cooks Illustrated stories have a very, very similar voice, despite the fact that they're written by many different people. It's because they're so heavily edited. But that's basically when I started writing, and I found out that I really enjoyed the writing part of it too. So I moved from a test cook position to an editorial position there, editing other stories, and then I started freelance writing on the side. And eventually, when I moved back to New York a few years later, I was a freelance writer looking for a job. I was a freelance writer and doing some private chef stuff, just to make ends meet. And that's when I, you know, met Ed Levine from Serious Eats and started writing for Serious Eats. And he suggested, he said, you know, you're a pretty good writer. You should have a column on Serious Eats. And so I said, okay, what should I? And he was like, what do you want to write about? And I said, well, I've always wanted to do a food science column. He's like, great. Like, well, we'll call it the Food Lab, and you know, you can turn in the first one next week. And that's how the first Food Lab column started, and it was about boiling eggs. So I spent a week. At the time, I was living in an apartment in Brooklyn, a one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn that had literally no windows. It was a cave in Brooklyn, and I spent a week in that cave, kind of boiling eggs, and then wrote 3,000 words about boiling eggs, and that was the first Food Lab article, and I think you can still find it online. I think it's 2009, something like that.
How many eggs did you boil that week?
Oh, I don't know, but it was hundreds. hundreds of eggs. I don't know. Hopefully, I don't know the exact number. I'm sure I have
a market that week, right?
Right.
So I'm interested in when you were studying biology, mm-hmm. you said that the lab work was tedious.
Yeah.
But it strikes me as certainly prep work in a kitchen, peeling onions and peeling lemons and cutting onions, like you said you like
right.
to do.
Can
and
be
boiling,
tedious too.
Boiling hundreds of eggs mm-hmm. in a week seems like it may also be tedious. So what's the difference? Talk about that a little bit.
No, you're right. I can see why that would be tedious. I guess the main difference is the well, partly because I think the end results are more pleasant in cooking, that you get to eat your results. It's also just a faster turnaround. You know, it's like when you're in a restaurant and it's like you get in there in the morning and you start prepping stuff, and then by the time service rolls around, like, you're done, right? You've started from scratch and created these things that that people are really, you know, that are bringing people together over a meal, that are bringing people pleasure, that people are like willing to pay money for because you've put this work into it. And so there is this sort of very, you know, some of the tasks can be repetitive and tedious, I guess, but there is a sort of very immediate and pleasant feedback that you get from it. And the idea that you're knowing that you're bringing people pleasure, I think is the main reason, I think, why the main reason why I cook and why I do what I do. And I think it is why for a lot of people as well. As far as the sort of experimenting and the writing goes, it really is just about the end result that, working in a restaurant, you're maybe feeding, a couple hundred people a night, somewhere in the hundreds per night. And it's probably like a very small subset of like a very rich part of the population. So you're bringing pleasure to people, but I find actually that testing recipes and writing is in a way more fulfilling because you're not cooking directly for anybody, but you are, I think, helping bring a lot of families together. You're helping a much wider range of people, and you're answering questions that I think are important to people, and that in the end will bring people around the table and bring families closer together, bring friends closer together, and that's, I think, really the reason why food, I think, is important to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm. Consider Bardwell Farm is a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm, making award-winning raw cow and goat's milk cheeses in a not-too-far corner of Vermont. For Consider Bardwell, sustainability means caring for the land, raising their animals well, reducing waste, and helping their community, all in the name of happy animals and people and delicious cheeses. Consider Bardwell Farm is proud to support Heritage Radio Network as part of their food and farming community and a proud sponsor of all good conversations had over great cheese. Find them at your local cheese counter, at New York City Green Markets, and online at considerbardwellfarm.com.
Welcome back to Chef Story. I'm here with J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, and we're talking about food science and the food lab. And Kenji, I find the science part, I think a lot of people find the science part of cooking very interesting, but also not that approachable. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about how your goal is to make it, I think your goal is to make it more approachable for the home cook.
Yeah, well, you know, I think people find, not just in cooking, but I think people find science in general to be a little bit hard to approach. And I think partly it's because I think there is a sort of misconception about what science is that sometimes is perpetuated by scientists as well, you know, because there is sort of hardcore science, like lab coat science, and of course there's huge value in that, but there are other types of science as well. You know, there's the science that you can do every day, and really, you know, science is not about like fancy words, and it's not about test tubes and things like that. It's really just about, you know, it's a method of sort of examining the world, making observations in the world around you, and using those observations to form theories. And it's really just a method of understanding what's going on, and sort of categorizing your thoughts so that you can get at the root of what's going on, as opposed to just making assumptions about things. So, you know, even in the example I give in the book is that, you know, when you buy a new toaster, You don't know, you know, oat toasters all have different settings. Like, I don't know, and when I have a brand new toaster, I don't know what five dark is going to, how dark the toast is going to come out. So maybe I'll set the toaster to five on the first day. I see it comes out too dark. Next day, I'll try setting it to three. It comes out too light. And then finally on the last day, I'll dial it into four. And, you know, and that is science. You know, I'm making an observation. I'm making a theory. I'm testing the results, and then I'm coming up with a conclusion. And that really is science. And that's the kind of science that I think you can do every day. And that's the kind of science that can also sort of help you understand better what's going on in your kitchen. So, for me, science is really more about skepticism and about wanting to answer questions than it is about sort of lab style science. I think there's also sort of a misconception that people have there's this false dichotomy that people think the science is sort of the opposite of culture or art or tradition or whatever, you know. And when people hear about food science, and this happens all the time, when, you know, people who aren't familiar with my work, if they ask me what I do, I'm like, oh, I write about food science. People will always say, oh, you mean like molecular gastronomy and stuff? And I'm like, no, not really. I mean, molecular gastronomy, and I think that is a sort of misconception. People think science means technology, science means new things, and it doesn't necessarily. You know, we can use science to understand new things, but we can also use science to understand traditional cooking methods. And just because we understand the science of something better doesn't mean that we have to throw those traditions out the window. It doesn't mean that we lose the artistry or the culture or the history. And I think it's actually quite the opposite. You know, it's like. If you say like say if you take a musician, right? Just because they maybe they're learning how to play the guitar and they can play a few chords and they have a sort of natural talent for it and they're very good at it. Teaching that person a little bit of music theory or teaching them more chords is not going to make them lose their art, right? It just gives them a sort of wider palette to work with, and it gives them a better understanding of what they're doing, which I think helps make you more expressive because it gives you finer control over what you're doing. So they're not really, you know, art and science are not really at odds with each other. I think they more complement each other.
I agree with that. I think that there are many chefs out there who maybe aren't buying what you're selling, so to speak. They feel that some of what you're doing contradicts the tried and true fundamental techniques. For example, in your book, you talk about blanching.
Right.
We teach, as most culinary schools, I would imagine, teach blanching technique, which, you know, pot of water.
Yep.
Which I think you agree with.
Mm-hmm.
Blanch your vegetables for a period of time, usually not a very long period of time, mm-hmm. in the boiling water, and then shock them in ice water.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the shocking part is something that you challenge.
A few people have actually. I think they did that in modernist. They challenged that in modernist cuisine also. And you find if you actually test it, you find that most of the time you don't actually need to shock. There are times when you do. But most of the time, if you take, you know, blanching your vegetables, taking them out and just spreading them on a sheet tray in like a single layer, or running them under cool water, that's enough to halt the cooking process. And they'll come out indistinguishable from vegetables that you do shock. The exception would be what you don't want to do is say, like, you know, blanch a couple quarts of peas and then pile them into a bowl, because then the heat from the ones on the outside can continue to cook the ones that are in the center of that bowl. So that you don't want to do that. But as long as your vegetables are in a single layer, the shocking doesn't really make much of a difference. And you also have to, I think you also have to realize that a lot of this stuff is contextual. This book is pretty squarely aimed at home cooks. I think there are a lot of techniques that sort of make sense in restaurant settings, that chefs tell home cooks to do because they make sense in restaurant settings, but they don't make sense at home. So, for example, blanching peas, nobody at home is going to be blanching 4 pounds of four or five pounds of peas at a time, which you might do in a restaurant, and in that case you might want to shock them in ice water because, you know, maybe you want to get them into the walk-in faster, or maybe you don't have enough, you don't want to tie up a bunch of large sheet trays to spread them out. Whereas at home, if you're blanching a cup of peas, it's not going to make any difference at all how you do after you take them out of that water.
So how do you feel about the, I don't know if it's the old guard, the old school chefs who seem to be just not really as interested in change and embracing the culinary technology that you and others are really you know, I think your analogy with the musician is a really good one. You're adding to, you're enhancing and enriching the technique and experience of new up and coming chefs. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about the old guard who's against that?
Well, I mean, I think sort of being against science from an ideological standpoint is just, I think it's just a weird way to live in the world, but it's also understandable. You know, it's like, and I tell people this all the time. It's like, you know, I'm going to do the test as fairly as possible and try and, you know, get as close as I can to the truth. Because, you know, science, you're never really getting the absolute truth. You can never say with absolute certainty that something is true. It's always sort of this quest to get closer and closer to the truth. So that's what I tell people. But at the same time, it's like, you know, if you've been cooking your macaroni and cheese the same way your whole life and you love the way that turns out, then there's no reason you should change it now just because something new came up. You know, maybe you might find that there are ways that maybe you can get to the same end result using and get there a little bit faster, maybe using one less pot or something like that. In those cases, if efficiency is something that matters to you, maybe you should change it. But if you love the way something is coming out and you've done it that way many times and you know that it's worked every time you've done it, then there's not really a reason to change. It's the same sort of thing that I get, like, because in the book and on the column online, I'll often say, like, oh, like, I'll call something the best version or the ultimate or whatever. And people are like, well, what do you mean best version? Like, and for me, you know, when I use those words, I don't really mean that it's the best version, because obviously there's no such thing as a best macaroni and cheese. It's all about what you like and what you want. So, you know, when I use a word like best or ultimate, it's really just more of an indicator that, like, this is one of the recipes where you're probably going to have to do a lot more steps than the way your grandmother did it. It'll maybe take 50% more work only to make it 5% better. But this is a recipe where I'm trying my hardest to make sure that, you know, flavor is the only thing that matters and not like efficiency or something else like that. But you know, at the end of the day, there is no such thing as best. It's all just a matter of personal taste and what you want and what you like. But you know, understanding the science is what's going to help you fine-tune a dish. So it's, you know, if you don't understand the science and you're just following a recipe, so I like to liken it to a if you're following like a map on your phone, where, you know, if you're just taking turn-by-turn directions, you can get from point A to point B pretty easily. But then what happens if, say, there's like construction on a street one day and you can no longer walk down that street? At that point, you have to sort of zoom out on the map and figure out what's going on and find your own way to the end route. And obstructions like that happen in the kitchen all the time. You know, you're not cooking on the same equipment that the person who tested the recipe is cooking on. Or maybe one day, you know, your power goes out and you can't use the microwave, so you have to figure out a different way to melt your butter or whatever it is. You know, understanding the science and technique helps you deal with situations as they arise, and it also helps you, you know, make recipes into your own, because you can choose your own route or you can choose your own destination a lot more easily than if you're just sort of following these step-by-step turns that are built into a recipe.
And technology, just for the sake of technology, never is really that helpful, right?
Technology for the sake of technology, I don't think it's helpful. I mean, I think it can be fun and interesting. Like, you remember, I'm sure, from like the early 2000s when sous vide machines were starting to show up in restaurants, and everybody was advertising the fact that their pork chop was cooked sous vide or their eggs were cooked sous vide. And you find that, yeah, at that point it was because it was a new toy and everybody had the new toy and wanted to play with it. But these days I think people now have realized, okay, like, it's just a tool. It does some things good. Like, I'm not going to try and use my hammer as a saw anymore. You know, like, it does some things good. It doesn't do other things good. Let's focus on what it does right. So at this point, people still use sous vide machines to cook, but they don't advertise the fact. And I think they use it in more intelligent ways. Technology for the sake of technology, I don't think is good, but new technology, I mean, can be great if you apply it right.
I agree with that. A student asked you yesterday about the sous vide machine, and you made a really good example with a nail gun, I think.
Yeah. Because I'm doing some remodeling on my home, and I'm doing like all the carpentry myself, so I've been buying myself a lot of new tools, and it was like I bought myself a nail gun that you attach to an air compressor a few months ago. And when I first got that nail gun, it was like the coolest thing. I just wanted to nail everything. Like, I wanted to nail everything because it was just so fun to play with. And then eventually you realize, okay, like, my nail gun is good for nailing things. I probably shouldn't just be nailing everything, though, because it's good for some things and not good for others.
Yep. New toys are fun to play
with.
They
are, yeah.
So walk me through your process. You're in the lab a lot. You're testing and and retesting. And I got to imagine, you know, take Thanksgiving turkey, for example, mm-hmm. which is often, you know, has been tested a million times
right.
over. So that may not be the best example, but how many turkeys do you cook in that example? So walk me through your process and pick any example you like.
Well, I mean, so we can talk about turkey. So my basic recipe development process, like, it always starts with a lot of research, and that's both sort of technical and technique and recipe research, and also sort of cultural and historic research. So because like I said, like what I don't want to do in my book is present recipes that will end up with end results that aren't really recognizable or that don't, you know, I always want the end result to speak to people in the way they expect it, you know. So if I'm developing a recipe for meatloaf, I want to make sure that the meatloaf I end up with is something that hits all the right meatloaf notes. You know, it's comforting in the right way, it looks right, it has the right sort of interplay of textures and flavors. Research always it starts by doing this historic and regional research and finding out what a dish means to people. So if I'm doing turkey, I might try and see, like, all right, like, how do people traditionally in New England, where, you know, the first Thanksgiving was, how do people in New England cook it? Right? How do people cook it in the South? How do people cook it in the Midwest? How do they cook it in California? And there you can sort of synthesize, like, all right, so I need my turkey to, you know, I need my turkey. Well, sometimes you'll find that things are extraordinarily regional, right? Chili, right? Chili in Texas is very different from what people think chili is up here.
Sure.
And in those cases, you don't try and make everyone happy, because you're not going. If you put beans in your chili recipe and call it Texas chili, people in Texas get pissed off at you. So sometimes you have to pick your battles and say, okay, I'm going to make like Texas style chili today, or I'm going to make Cincinnati chili today, right? And so you have to really find out. You have to really sort of decide what it is you're after. And that's sort of the first step of the process. It's like, I'll come up with a list of like what my turkey needs to be. It needs to be juicy. It needs to have crispy golden skin. I guess those are really the only big major things in turkey. I guess maybe it has to have like a deep turkey flavor. And then after that, I'll start looking at techniques, and I'll sort of get a survey of all the different recipes out there and see what people have tested and tried in the past. And then the next step would sort of be to identify areas where I think there might be interesting scientific questions, or perhaps, you know, questions that people haven't answered very thoroughly, or where there might be problems. And those problems could be anything from, you know, it takes a very long time to use this method. Like, is there a faster way we can do it? Or it could be that. So, for instance, I wrote an article about turkey a few years ago that focused on brining. And to me, the problem with brining is that, you know, it solves one problem very well. It ensures that your turkey stays moist. But to me, it introduces another problem, which is that it makes your turkey taste watered down, because the moisture that you're adding to it is straight up water. So the focus of that article was like, okay, well, you know, clearly we have this pretty clearly laid out problem. Now, what's the science behind it, and how do we solve it? And so then all the testing phase is really about trying to answer those questions and trying to solve them. And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. So things don't always go the way you plan them to.
Which is something I'd like to talk about. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
All right, welcome back. So, Kenji, right before the break, you talked a little bit about started to talk about when things don't work out. Tell me a little bit more about when things work out. Do you ever just give up on testing something? And how do you treat what I would call failure in the kitchen?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't really ever give up on testing things. Sometimes I put things aside. Like, for instance, I've been trying to work out a recipe for homemade ramen noodles that I've never been really happy with. You know, for me, like, homemade ramen noodles, I've never really made ramen noodles that I think are better than sort of the good fresh store-bought brands I can get, that, you know, like Sun Noodle, I think, makes really great fresh ramen noodles that you can just buy at the supermarket. And so I've never been able to make a noodle that's better than that. So I've sort of been putting that one aside, pushing that one off, and people keep asking me, when are you going to have a ramen noodle recipe? I don't have one yet, but I'm still working on it. But I guess that question of failure in the kitchen, I think a lot of people are scared about failing in the kitchen, and people do get nervous when they're cooking for friends or when they're cooking for family, that they're going to mess a recipe up or that something's not going to come out the right way. For me, I think it's the wrong way to think about it, because you have to keep in mind what the point of food is, right? And for me, All right, there's obviously to fill that hole in your belly, but I think the real point of food and why we put effort and care into making trying to make food taste good is that we want people to come together over a meal. You know, we want to bring our friends and we want our family and we want everyone to sit around a table and have a good time as friends and family. And that's really what I think the role of the food is. So, you know, so if you're having a dinner party and, you know, and you've got like your six friends over or you got your family over for the holidays, then I think the food has basically already served its purpose. You know, it's already gotten the people there. So, you know, it's done most of its job. And at that point, you know, if you mess up, if your mayonnaise breaks or if you slightly overcook your turkey, I don't think it really matters. You know, just own up to it. Say, oops, I overcooked the turkey, and you can still have a great night. And it does. I don't think it ruins anything. And, you know, and to be honest, and think about it going the other way around. Like if you go over to a friend's house, like, when was the last time you had a friend who cooked a perfect meal for you? Probably never, right? There's always going to be something wrong, but you don't really care, right? You're not going to call them out on it. You're not going to say, oh, that meal was terrible. You're just going to remember having a good time at a friend's house. And frankly, if you have the kinds of friends who are going to come over to your house and complain that your turkey is overcooked, then you probably don't want them coming over to your house anymore anyway. So I think it's totally fine to fail in the kitchen, especially as a home cook. You know, it's a little bit different if you're in a restaurant and people are paying money and they have a certain expectation. But as a home cook, like, it's totally fine to try new things and to not be afraid to try these new things, because if you mess them up a little bit, then who really cares, right? It's at the end of the day, it's you know, I like to say that, you know, it's just pizza. Like it's pizza's great, but it's still just pizza. It's not like we're not curing cancer. We're not sending people to the moon. We're just making pizza here, right?
Agreed. And in a restaurant kitchen, you can refire it.
Right.
A little
yes.
bit more difficult
yes.
to do at a dinner party, right? So a burning question I have for you or for anybody who is actively testing lots of recipes in a lab situation, who eats all the food? Who are your tasters? And can I be one?
Well, when I lived in New York, it was my mom and my grandfather and my doorman. My doorman always took tons of leftovers home to their families. These days, I live out in San Mateo in California, and I happen to be of an age where all of my friends are having babies, so there are a lot of people who happily take food because they don't have the time to cook anymore. So my neighbors and friends get most of my food now. Also my dogs and my wife, obviously, as well.
That's good. Very very good community service.
Dogs eat well.
Your dogs are fantastic. I love the photos of your dogs in their book. And my youngest daughter, Juliet, who's seven, loves your, I think it's a pug.
Sharpei.
Yeah, Sharpei. Yeah. And she can't get enough of those photos. So tell me about the dogs. Are your dogs, you know, always around and you know, looking for scraps and having fun with your intestine?
So right now I have two dogs and they have sort of opposite personalities. Hamon is a Sharpei pug. Well, he's actually half pug, a Sharpei pug, and he is a very picky eater. Like ever since he was a puppy, he's been a picky eater, and it's sometimes hard to get him to eat. And you know, I usually cook for my dogs. So I'll make like this. I make like a stew in the pressure cooker. So basically, like a bunch of ground meat, some vegetables, squash, eggs, and usually some kind of grains. And I just cook it all in the pressure cooker. And I make it in big batches and then freeze it every few weeks. So I'll usually cook for my dogs. But then sometimes I'll run out and I just don't have time to make more, and I'll feed him like dry kibble, and he'll just go over to the bowl and like stare at it and like look up at me and then just turn around and walk away, and he won't eat it until he's really desperate for food. The other dog is the opposite. The other dog, Shabu, is a little mutt, and she is super food obsessed, like, and will eat anything. The dogs are pretty well trained, so they know not to come into the kitchen, but she'll hang around just outside and wait for me to spill something or whatever, and then run over and grab it and take it and hide and eat it on her own. But the dogs are good. They're a good pair with opposite personalities.
Well, my dog is at least 16 years old, and so her hearing has gone. So it's a good thing, because if she heard this radio show, I think she'd be expecting a little bit better dining. Tell me about who inspires you. Or what inspires you?
You know, I think the biggest inspiration for the book and the column I do now is not a chef or a food writer. I would say I was a big fan of Mr. Wizard as a kid, which is a, you know, the kids' science show. And I think, you know, just the way he was able to explain sort of rather complicated scientific principles in a very simple way, using, you know, using analogies and using diagrams, and explaining it in a way that people could really grasp it, I think was really great. And, you know, and was an essential part of my education growing up. I think, you know, the concepts that I learned watching Mr. Wizard when I was like 8 years old, those basically carried me through, you know, physics and chemistry and biology classes all the way through college. I mean, obviously, there things get more complex as you start to add the math and the real nitty gritty stuff behind it. But conceptually, you know, his method of explaining was, I think, just wonderful. And so that's sort of the kind of stuff that I try to bring into my book. You know, trying to explain sort of complicated things using words that are not just words that people understand, but words that are fun and that you know, I guess I think of it as sort of like folding the broccoli into the macaroni and cheese, you know, where I want the book to first be fun to read, and then if you learn something in the process, then that's great too. But you know, the real hook is to get people to start reading it and enjoying themselves while they're reading it, so that I think when you're having fun, lessons really stick a lot more than if you're just being taught. You know, like I hated going to lecture because you're just sitting there and someone is telling you things and I don't really absorb information that way. I absorb things by doing them or when I'm really enjoying myself, I'm much more attentive. So I think making it fun and understandable is really the first step, and that's what Mr. Wizard brought to science for me. I guess, you know, someone like Jacques Pepin is also a huge influence, because I think he had a sort of similar approach as well. You know, he's one of those guys that could just make everything look easy, but he also had like an extremely approachable teaching manner and is just like such a watchable, interesting guy. You know, you look for, I think even people who aren't into cooking enjoy watching Jacques Pepin's shows just because he's just such a easy guy to get along with and an easy guy to watch.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, I think your book is really going to make it fun for a lot of people. I think cooking is less of a task for a lot of people now than and more of a hobby than it ever has been, which I'm really happy about. But I think your book kind of combines that, you know, the way things work with mm-hmm. a cookbook, and I think that's a really phenomenal thing for a lot of people who are really starting to learn, and for people like me who know what they're doing to look at it a different way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I certainly highly recommend the book to everybody. Tell me a little bit more about your next project.
Well, the next project is a follow-up book. This book, the version that came out is a single volume. It's like 900 and something pages. But originally we were going to release a two-volume box set, and each one was going to be around 800 pages. So the material I wrote and worked on for it is actually a lot more than what ended up getting published. In the end, we've decided that a two-volume box set was a little bit too pricey, especially sort of for a first-time book. And so we cut it down to this one volume. But there's still a few, you know, several hundred pages of stuff that I had that was going to go into this book. So that's forming the sort of the basis of the next book. And now I'm in the process of adding a lot more things to it. So I think it'll end up probably being... I'm saying it's going to be a little bit shorter, but you know, originally this book was supposed to be 300 pages, and it just kind of grew. So it'll probably end up growing to something similar in size. My deadline is July. This book, I missed my deadline by 3 years. I think I'll get closer than 3 years on the next one, but hopefully it'll be out in stores fall of 2017.
Good. We look forward to it. Well, thank you, Kenji, for the conversation today, and thanks to the Chef Story team. Dorothy will be back with another interview next week, and I thank you all for listening. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.